You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
So just a reminder, we do have a Spanish speaker on the panel. So if you set your little earpiece to channel 2, it will translate to English. Channel 10, which is one arrow up to Spanish.
Sorry.
Okay.
My English is terrible.
This will be fun.
Yes.
So my name is Greg Topa. I'm a senior editor at Inside Higher Ed. The topic of this panel is slightly different. We are kind of moving forward talking about unburdening teachers, harnessing the power of community, expertise, and technology. We have a really wonderful panel of real practitioners who are about to chat with us. By the way, I think I'll be able to write in this panel now that my fingers are all sort of... you know, it occurred to me as Rebecca was giving her talk, really wonderful, very exciting stuff. It occurred to me that we are in a lot of ways leapfrogging already, even though we don't know it, in so many areas. And when I think about I think about this thing in my pocket and all of your pockets. I'm sure you all have one of these. What I like to say is that about 10 years ago, we started giving these things, we started handing these things out to our kids on sort of this massive, unprecedented scale. And 10 years later, the result is we have universal telephone ownership among young people. They're the first generation in which everyone has a phone. And they're also the first generation that hates to talk on the phone. I don't know. I have two daughters. They're now in their 20s. They've grown up with cell phones. They would pretty much rather do anything than talk to you on the phone. Until recently, we had a phone on our wall at home, you know, and when it rang, I don't know about you folks, when the phone rang in my house, nobody gets it. And one of the reasons I think the cell phone is so powerful to the young people is because it does something we didn't even think it would do when we built it. Well, when I say we, I didn't build it, but it became in some ways this sort of weird trust machine. What do I mean by that? When we all grew up, even the youngest among us, our parents said things like, don't talk to strangers, don't get in their cars, certainly don't visit their houses and go to sleep, don't date them, and for God's sakes, don't marry them. And, a generation later, we do all of these things pretty much without thinking about it, right? We talk to strangers all day on Twitter. We get in their cars, certainly, with ride sharing. We sleep in their houses, Airbnb. We date them, right? Tinder, OkCupid, and sometimes we even marry them. It strikes me that if we could make a change that profound happen in everyone's lives with something like this, it seems to me that that figuring out who in the community can help teachers is kind of an easy lift. And I say that knowing that it's kind of a naive assertion, but I think I like to explore it in that context. So we have a really wonderful panel, very diverse. group of people. I'm just going to introduce them from my left all the way down. They're going to tell us a little bit about what they do, and then we'll take it from there. And when I say a little bit, I mean very little bit, like 1 or 2 minutes.
Okay.
So that's the first challenge. So Manolo is to my left, please.
Thank you, Greg. Hi, everybody. My name is Manolo Diaz, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Yogomi. Thanks for the invitation. Happy to be here. Yogomi is a learning content platform for kids 5 to 11 years old, available in 6 different languages, with content for 8 different subjects, from math, science, to coding and sustainability. We actually recently added social-emotional learning as well, and we see over 6 million monthly active users from over 20 countries in our platform. Thank you.
Wow, very nice.
Very concise as well.
You have to beat that, Alison. That was about 40 seconds.
Challenge not accepted. Hi, I'm Alison Natalin. I'm the founder and CEO of Lively Minds. We work in very rural and deprived, off the grid, very hard to reach villages in Ghana and Uganda, where most parents have never been to school. Schools are very poorly funded, very large class sizes. And we aim to improve early childhood development in those settings. Firstly, and our primary focus is empowering mum. So we train 40 women in each village, and then the mothers are trained to run play groups for the preschoolers in their community to give children the chance to learn through play. We also give parents ongoing parenting workshops. But also, particularly where we work in Ghana, the play groups all happen inside the school kindergarten, and we use the program to also tackle some of the challenges that face the quality issues in kindergarten, in particular large class sizes and lack of teacher expertise in how to teach through play. So each day, a group of the trained mums come into the classroom and can teach the children in small groups using homemade toys, and that helps teachers to teach because obviously they have extra hands, lots of teaching assistants, and they're also given training on how to use these games.
Okay.
My name is David Calle. I have a YouTube channel called Unicos with math, physics, chemistry, and tech videos in Spanish. We have more than 1 million followers. And it has been seen approximately 150 million times by 20 or 30 million students, mostly Spanish-speaking. Half of them are in Spain, the other half are in Latin America, and this is for middle school, high school, and college. We launched a website called unicos.com, and in addition to our free videos there, we have other things. Everything we do there is free. Our goal is to give equal opportunities to all. In addition to our videos, we have exercises with answers, theory, and we also have a Q&A forum where people can post their questions online and we can answer them. We have professors, teachers, and students from all over the world, and they are helping each other with their homework assignments and their assignments. We are trying to grow by adding new subjects and adding other languages. We are starting to do this in Arabic for children who are refugees in other countries, including Spain, who might not speak Spanish, and they're trying to learn Spanish or Italian. We're doing this little by little. It's tough because since it's free and we're not charging anybody for this, it's difficult to finance this project, but we love what we're doing and we try to help as many children as we can. We're trying to keep helping them achieve their dreams. That's our goal.
Somebody a little high. I know we've got a high mic somewhere.
Yeah. My ear is it's broken now. It's broken now.
You can turn down the earpiece. Oh, okay. Got two mics.
It's feeding back. You're feeding on top of yourself. Nah, it's not the problem.
So just in case you didn't think you'd hear the words Brookings and YouTube star in the same sentence, you now have. Okay. Hadi.
Hi, my name is Hadi Partovi. I'm the founder and CEO of Code.org, and also the person who started this movement called the Hour of Code. my goal in life and my belief is that every school should teach computer science. One thing I was reflecting on when Rebecca was talking earlier about how we have this issue about a skills gap, but also a skills uncertainty, and this question of what are the skills we'll need in the future, my opinion is that we have a skills certainty, which is that computer science is going to be needed in the future, and that in every career, in every country, we're going to have more and more jobs that require digital skills of some sort, and our schools aren't preparing them for this. Code.org is helping schools and actually states and governments add computer science to the curriculum. In the United States, we've helped 43 states out of 50 adopt policies to embrace computer science. We've also built the world's most popular platform for learning to code in schools. Roughly 10% of all the students in the world have tried Code.org because our platform, the early tutorials are available in over 50 languages. In the United States, which has been our area of focus, almost half of schools use Code.org. In the fifth grade, which is our most popular year, two-thirds of all American students have an account on Code.org. So as an example of how fast technology can be used to spread an innovation for something that didn't even exist 5 years ago, the fact that we've penetrated that level is an amazing testament to how technology can impact education. With respect to this panel, I would say our work relies fundamentally on teachers. Even though we provide a curriculum that spreads online, it spreads online from teachers to students. We have almost 1 million teachers teaching our curriculum in schools. Most of them never learned computer science when they were themselves in school, but now they're teaching computer science using Code.org.
And I want to get to that. That's actually the first question I want to start with. By the way, in case it's not clear, I'm going to deputize all four of you to talk to each other as well as to me. So I'd like to make this as much of a conversation as possible. I like to say, well, I'm going to have brunch without the Bloody Marys. Okay. Does Bloody Mary translate?
Bloody Mary.
Okay. Well, nothing could be easier. So actually, let's start with you, Hadi. Your remark about sort of teachers being the interface between the curriculum and the kids. First question I wanted to ask was sort of how you folks see yourselves as working within this idea of unburdening the teachers. You're relying on the teachers. Do you see yourself unburdening them?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that.
You know, I think if you started from a blank slate and thought, how can technology make education better, there's a number of ways you'd basically find ways for technology to reduce the work of the teacher. But that doesn't mean to eliminate the teacher. The simplest thing is grading homework. Teachers spend so much of their time grading homework, and that is something that could be automated. In many cases, delivering a lecture can be done better with an engaging video. You can get the world's greatest experts to deliver a lecture. So for us, you know, in our curriculum, when we teach computer science, we have people like Bill Gates giving a lecture on how a computer works, which is more interesting, I think, for most people than the majority of teachers giving that lecture.
Well, couldn't
the
you
homework
all?
Grades itself. Could the teacher plays a
could
role.
Could you give my phone to Bill Gates, please?
Sure. Thank you.
All right, our work here is done.
I think that technology can help teachers a lot. I record videos, but I'm not saying that a video could ever replace a teacher. What teachers can contribute to their students is priceless. It has an incalculable value. The idea of videos is just to shake things up in the classroom a little bit. If we look at the time that teachers can make up, the time that teachers can have in the classroom because students have already seen videos outside of the classroom, it can be much more productive in classroom, but teachers will be able to talk to their students more, they'll be able to get to know their students more, and they can do this because they'll have much more time since they don't have to keep explaining the same equation again and again or the same scientific concept. So as I'm saying, teachers can have more time in the classroom to get to know their students, which I think is key. Many of our students want to have a wonderful career, but we want them to be better people. We want them to engage in teamwork and be resistant to failure. And I think that those skills are very important as well. This generation has a lot of virtues, but they have some defects as well. They're more impatient.
This generation of children, not teachers.
No, not teachers. And in the case of our teachers, if they can use videos, if they can use any kind of online or digital platform and take advantage of that, they can make their classes much more fun and much more intense.
Anybody want to?
Yeah, I mean, at the end is how can we empower teachers with either content, with tools that can help them do their task on a more easy way. Mm-hmm. In our case, we started with a model only for parents, for consumers. Selling to schools is well known that it's not easy. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. The sales cycle is really difficult. It takes a lot of time. So in our case, we decided to create a product for schools to start with teachers so they can use it for free. Since this school year, well, last year, our content is available for some beta testing. We're actually doing beta testing with some schools in Mexico and here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And starting this new school year, the product will be available for free for all those schools that want to use it. And that's important because we're generating this content now with a validation from a top university here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And for us, the opportunity to get this content to more teachers where they can actually have the flexibility to use it as they can, because that's important. Sometimes these content platforms, they are like not flexible, and they don't give the opportunity to the teacher to actually like optimize and use it as they prefer. Mm-hmm. They have to use it as it is, mm-hmm. and not to be flexible so they can, oh, I will use this content for this kid and this for other students, for example. So for us, it's important that they also have like these tools to personalize their learning experience for their students.
So I guess as the non-tech practitioner on the panel.
So you know there are three engineers and you and me. You're outnumbered.
So I guess I probably come at this from a slightly different take. I guess the teachers that we work with, there are a number of quite tricky challenges. So one of them is certainly that they have an almost impossible task in that the average class size that we work with is around 60 children to one kindergarten teacher. Hmm. And there are no teaching resources and often, you know, in a very, very small cramped classroom. So with the best will in the world, and even if you had the very best trained teacher, it's going to be really tough for them. So that's one factor, and that's certainly where we look at how we can unburdening them by crowding the classroom with community members to help mm-hmm. with that workload. But on the other hand, there are also other challenges and other really important barriers, one of which is teacher capacity, and the other one of which is teacher motivation.
Just so we're clear, what's your definition of teacher capacity?
Teacher capacity, I'd say, is that a lot of these kindergarten teachers are not trained in kindergarten teaching and often not trained in teaching at all. Mm. And so there is an issue, there's a training need. And then on the other hand, there's also a motivation issue. There's incredibly high rates of teacher absenteeism. There's quite poor accountability. There's quite poor sort of governance of teaching. And what we found when we first started to introduce the program, originally when we started implementing, we had this wonderful idea that we'd come in, we'd train the mums and the teachers together, and then they'd all get this excellent training, mm-hmm. and then the teachers would lead the mums and would be able to run these playgroups. Mm-hmm. And actually that didn't happen, because then what essentially happened was the teachers saw this as our intervention, they saw this as an external thing that they had sort of nothing to do with, mm-hmm. and actually increased the absenteeism problem, because then the teachers
felt, so it was
felt,
a break.
Here are these, you know, 7-8 mums coming in, I can just sneak off and not teach. So instead what we did was we said, okay, teachers, we're going to train you, but it's your responsibility to train 40 mums in the village. It's your responsibility to supervise them. It's your responsibility to provide the ongoing work. So in that sense, we're not unburdening them at all. We're actually demanding that they make quite a big investment. But on the other hand, what we're not doing is we're not bypassing them. We're making them the owners of the problem. We're empowering them. And so I think... Yes, they. In the end, the outcome is that they do become unburdened because there is this complementary workforce, this volunteer workforce coming in and allowing them to give more quality teaching and allowing the mums to contribute. But on the other hand, that does not necessarily mean reduced work or sort of reduced effort.
It's a different kind of unburdening.
It's a different kind of effort.
Yeah. You know, Hadi, as you were talking earlier, it occurred to me that there are some people, maybe some teachers, who might have the same attitude toward what you're doing as what Allison just said, which is, you know, one more thing for me to do. How do you persuade people that that's not the case? Or maybe you don't have to, and I'm just not understanding your pitch going in.
Well, most of the teachers who use code.org are really excited to have one more thing to do, just because they have the same view that... you know, when you enter a school, it feels like going back into a time machine, looking at the, you know, it feels like you're back in the 1850s.
So they're saying, bring it on.
Yeah, I think teachers, by and large, know that the future is changing, and they wonder, should they be preparing the kids for the same things that we've been teaching for the last 100 years? But really, if they have intimidation, within 10 minutes of having the kids engage with coding and computer science, that changes the mind for the teacher. Mm-hmm. Because they immediately see that the kids love it. They are enjoying it. And, you know, as a teacher, you don't always find one tool that everybody in the classroom is going to enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. Coding and computer science has very much become that. Mm-hmm. It engages the students. They quiet down. They do their work on the computer. Mm-hmm. It makes the teaching job much easier if the majority of the classroom is learning on their own. And then you go around to the students that need help.
I mean, is there any indication that it's replacing something else, that it's kind of crowding something else out? You know, there's only a certain amount of time in a day.
Sure. In primary school, the way most of our teachers introduce coding and computer science is as part of a play hour.
Okay.
So, you know, in primary school, you have to alternate between, you know, learn some math, learn some dance, you know, learn some English, learn some music. You know, just because the kids can't just do math and English or math and language all day, every hour. And coding and computer science becomes one of the sort of more fun activities just because the kids enjoy it so much.
Mm-hmm.
In secondary school, students get to choose what classes they want to take. You know, you can choose, do you want to take biology or chemistry or physics? And computer science becomes one of those choices for students.
Let's talk a little bit about, there was a really interesting point about it's not innovation if it's not scalable. I think, Hadi, you've checked the scaling box in some way, right? What was your percentage of students who've given it a try?
Trying code.org is 10% of the world's students, about 150 million.
You are the nuclear leapfrog.
Whoa. Whoa.
So let's talk a little bit about scaling. David, you were talking about how YouTube is a worldwide platform. How do you scale something on something like what you're doing on YouTube without being, you know, Cardi B? So rap. Baby boomers there. Yes.
We do it with a lot of passion. That's what I was saying. I am a teacher, in fact. I am an engineer, but I teach classes for a living. I would call on all teachers around the world to record their lessons or to look for other videos online for their students to watch. It's very important for teachers to use videos, not for the teacher, him or herself, but rather for students to all end up at the same level. In Spanish, this happens, and I'm sure this takes place in Latin America as well, because I hear from many students and teachers in Latin America. In middle school and high school, the biggest problem that they have is that half the class is learning at a much different pace than the other half the class. So the teacher starts explaining something in the classroom and half the students are lost and they just tune out. They don't have a strong enough foundation to have that lesson. And not all children learn at the same speed. That doesn't mean that they're more or less intelligent. There are people that learn very slowly. And that doesn't mean that they're less intelligent. In fact, some of the greatest scientists in the history of humanity were slow learners. These videos allow students to go home or be anywhere at any time with the internet, and they can rewind the video and watch it again. With that format, children and teenagers can do something they're used to doing. They were born practically with YouTube, and they are on YouTube all day. They spend their leisure time on YouTube, and they can have math, physics, programming, all of that on YouTube as well. That's very important, because these students can go at their own pace at home, and they can reach a certain level, and that way the next day in class, the teacher can have all students pay attention to the lesson at the same time, and that's very important for the teacher. Plus, it's more fun to watch a video at home than to do 50 division problems on a piece of paper. I think that it can help a lot, and it is helping, in fact.
It strikes me that there's also an equality piece to this, that if I need to watch, you know, me the student, if I need to watch your video three times, that's nobody's business. Right? It's between me and the my laptop.
Exactly. Many of these students weren't doing well at all, and we've seen incredible progress. I know that children with dyslexia, with ADHD, deaf children, people with all kinds of issues use these videos. Deaf children can use them because they have subtitles. Recently, the mother of a blind child told me that he started watching my videos, and since he started doing that, he's been doing math much better and he likes it much more. He can hear my voice at home. It's much easier to do this with a video. It's really cheap, actually. All you have to do is have the interest and devote yourself to it. When I started out, I thought there would only be 40 students, and now we have much more. You're giving equal opportunities to all. I do it free. So no matter how much money somebody has, they have the same chances. Not everybody can get a private tutor. I do it at home, and anybody in a public or private space can do it. I would encourage all teachers to do this because I think that it can be very important, not just in math, but in history, English, any subject. Videos can be very important for use in all these subjects.
I want to come back to the free word in a second, but let's talk a little bit more about equality. Do you folks in general see your tools as tools of equality?
Absolutely.
Totally.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, totally. I mean, in our case, when we started, we of course, went with teachers to understand how we can make our content more engaging, not only for private school students or public, for all the students. And the feedback was, I mean, make something that is exciting and engaging for kids. Mm-hmm. In our case, the Yogomi story, we have good guys and bad guys. Mm-hmm. Kids are the heroes who save the world with the power of their knowledge. So they are fighting against evil queen ignorantia, and this story engages kids. Mm-hmm. I remember when we launched our first games, having reviews from parents, because we have these battles inside of our games, and parents were like, I'm not sure if a game with math and battles is the best for my kid, but I have never seen my kid so engaged with math. Mm-hmm. So that is actually pretty, pretty exciting for me. So having those elements that, I mean, kids are used to. They are used to, like, seeing the most advanced movies, playing the latest console games. So we can't, deny ourselves that we need to create content with quality. And at the end, this content will impact all kids. We need to make sure of that, of course. In our case, I mean, we were talking about like partnerships in the previous panel. In our case, through partnerships, we are taking our content through all these organizations we are partnering with, organizations that are donating tablets that includes our content for free. So at the end, that content can impact any kid in the world for sure.
You know, anybody else want to tackle the equality question?
Yeah. I wanted to say something about equality, which is, you know, the reason I started Code.org is because computer science is an opportunity equalizer, because the computer doesn't know who's using it. The computer doesn't know, is it being used by a boy or a girl? Are they black or Hispanic or white? But the education opportunity in computer science has been very unequal, and we're headed into a world where it's going to be even more unequal unless countries do something about it. Right now, the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, South Korea, Japan, these countries have all basically begun rolling out computer science at a national level or at a state level. Whereas if you look at Latin America, most of the countries haven't decided that this should be part of the curriculum. And I think this is another round of an industrial revolution we're going to see, where the technology leaders are going to be in these countries that are basically adopting this in their education system.
You know, just to follow up on that, I mean, you know, you must get a lot of cynics who say, you know what, you're going to teach my kid some computer language in 2018, and in 2019 it'll be obsolete. I know you have a reply to that.
That's a great question.
But what's your reply?
Yeah, so in our curriculum at Code.org, we teach the things that have stuck around for 50 years.
Anything stuck around for 50
years?
Yeah.
Okay. We teach the concepts rather than the individual programming language.
Okay.
So the programming language, you know, when I was growing up, you'd learn Pascal, where today nobody uses Pascal. Whereas the concepts of things like functions and variables, those have existed since, you know, they're mathematical functions that you can also use in code. The concepts of conditionals or logic, things like understanding how the internet works, the protocols of the internet. The internet has changed a lot in the last 50 years, but the protocols are the exact same. So we teach the things that are going to stand the test of time.
And while we're talking about standing the test of time, I just wanted to ask you if you could to give us the short version of what I think is this wonderful idea you have about teaching long division. Because I think it's really in the context of skills that are useful moving forward. Could you just share that with us?
Yeah, something I say is that in education, there's so many debates about how we teach, how can we teach better, and there's very little debate about what we teach. What should our children learn? Most of what we teach is the same thing we've been teaching for hundreds of years.
And we're not really sure why, right?
just because, why do we teach it? Because we always taught it. And my favorite example of this is long multiplication and long division. Everybody in this room spent at least 6 months of your life learning how to multiply one long number by another long number to get an even longer number. None of us use that in our day-to-day lives. We all have computers and phones to do that. There was a time when every job needed that, whether you wanted to become an engineer, a financial analyst, a scientist, if you wanted to work in insurance, you needed to know how to do long division and long multiplication. In fact, the job title, if you were really good at it, you could be a computer. That was your job, to become a computer.
So computers were people.
Right. Today, there's only one job in the world that requires knowing how to do long multiplication or long division, which is math teacher. That's the only job it prepares you for. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't teach long division or a long multiplication, but do we need 6 months of repeating and getting good at this thing that you will never use again? You don't use it in calculus. You don't use it in algebra. You only use it in third and fourth and fifth grade, and then you forget it because you never ever need it again. I think it would be much better to teach long division as an algorithm, or teach multiplication as an algorithm, and walk through writing the algorithm for how to do it, but don't practice it because the computer now does that for us.
You know, I wanted to switch gears just a tiny bit in the time we have left. Talk a little bit about this pathway idea that Rebecca was mentioning. This idea that, you know, we've always had this concept of first we give access to school, then we improve the academic quality, and then we make it relevant to the real world. It strikes me that all of you have totally shattered that in some way. I wanted to pick on you, Allison, because it seems like you are the one who relies a little bit more than most on K kids being in school in a certain way. I guess maybe Hadi too. Maybe I'll pick on both of you. Do you see what you do working in another way? Maybe outside of school without having to rely on the institution?
Yes, so we work in both Ghana and Uganda. In Ghana, we work in schools. In Uganda, there is no there's no state-provided kindergarten. And then the private school system that does exist generally isn't in these remote villages. Mm. And so the program works in Uganda essentially by using community health workers who then train the mums, who then run the playgroups as a sort of just informal informal afternoon club. So it works fine. It's slightly harder to scale, but we're working through local government and through the health system route. Obviously, then what it doesn't do is it doesn't tackle the quality, the school quality issue, but it has other benefits in terms of the community. So, yes, I definitely think being in school sort of isn't a prerequisite for the program. Mm-hmm. And I'd also say, when we're talking about teachers, I think it's really important to remember that teachers doesn't have to just include professional workforce. And what we're showing with the program is that parents, even illiterate parents who we work with, are more than capable and, in fact, are probably the best teachers. There are, and as was talked about earlier, children do spend the majority of their life at home rather than in school. And so I think it's really important that we look at how can we unburden parents so that they have more time to teach as well as teachers.
And just back to you briefly, Hadi, the idea of code.org totally outside of school, I imagine it exists in some way, but...
40% of our students are outside of classrooms and schools, but our personal focus is on the school because of the issue of equality. Mm. You know, every student goes to school, and this is a subject that should be taught in schools to give everybody access. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the reason I'm here is to help ministers of education from other countries who haven't adopted computer science to work with us to help figure out how to make it part of the school system.
David, I wanted to ask you, kind of push on your idea a little bit. You know, we've heard this morning, the first couple of panels, this idea of innovation. YouTube is kind of a traditional pedagogy. Watching a video, even two or three times, or, you know, building something around it is very traditional. And that's been one of the criticisms that, you know, the so-called flipped classroom has gotten, right? Which is, what's the innovation? How do you respond to that?
Well, in my case, what I try to do is give different kinds of classes. It is true that you're talking about division and square roots, and I explain the same thing that many teachers explain in the classroom. However, in all of the videos, or almost all of them, I try to introduce concepts related to video games, superheroes, airplanes, buildings. I try to tie everything that we see in class to the real world and what the students actually love. As Hadi was saying, we can't keep teaching math the same way that we did 40 years ago when we didn't have the internet. We have to change the way that we do things, and we have to show our students that science is not just letters and numbers on a piece of paper. We can't turn our students into calculators because that doesn't make sense in the current time, and we don't need to teach them to memorize things either because they can just look things up by clicking a mouse. We need to teach them why they're doing things. So if I'm explaining something in a physics video, like a pendulum, I'll put Spider-Man there. If there's a lever, I'll do something with Thor. I can describe something with airplanes or a beautiful building that we have in Spain. I explain the same concepts as traditional teachers, but by recording videos, you can be more creative. You can spend more time on the explanation, and you can explain division without your students interrupting, for example, and you can take that creativity into your videos. That's what we try to do. We try to connect with our students more and try to give them STEM videos. We try to teach math and physics and science, and that's all very important. But as he said, we have to change the way that we are explaining things because it simply doesn't make sense for our students to figure out square roots or do 50 multiplication problems. We have to teach them why that matters. Derivatives are wonderful, as are integral numbers and that sort of thing, but we have to teach our students why that is important and how it can be applied in the real world. If there were no math, there would be no video games. There wouldn't be WhatsApp or Google. There wouldn't be code.org. Students have to be able to connect to what they are learning so that they can feel inspired to pay attention in science class, which is fascinating.
Anyone who want to react to that? That unassailable statement?
I said, do you understand me?
You know, all of you to some extent have come, obviously independently of one another, but have come to see the power of play or playfulness in your work. And I wonder, has that been an easy sell for parents and teachers and systems, or has it been difficult? I'll just open up to anyone who wants to.
Can I?
Sure.
We've worked quite hard on how we market the program to the community, to parents. And I think there is an expectation that school is, you know, a very formal setting, and you go in, and in our settings, you know, the teacher will recite from the blackboard, and there's this view of expected what a classroom looks like. But actually, when you show people why an alternative method is more effective, they generally are really open to it. Mm. So I think it's really about communication and about showing parents and teachers why playful learning is going to be effective. So I think if you just tell someone, hey, if you can learn through play and then you'll get really great results, they probably mm-hmm. wouldn't believe you. But if you show them, like, here's a game, what have you learned, then mm-hmm. really quickly, I think, then parents and educators can very quickly buy in to the concept. So I think we just need to be aware that it's not necessarily obvious to sort of to everyone why play is so important, but I tend to find that people are really open to it once they see the power of playful learning.
In my case, the parents love what we're doing. Some of them watch my videos so that they can explain these things to their children, and some of them love it because they say that when they hear my voice coming out of the laptop in their child's room, they know that their kid is at least studying and not just playing around. And many parents say, that's great, let them watch the videos. Since they know that Unicos is there, they don't have to be so concerned about their children doing their homework so they can have more free time to do other things. So they love it.
For us, especially in the primary school, our curriculum feels like a game.
Yeah.
The reason it's spreading so quickly in schools is it makes school more fun. You know, mostly students don't think of school as fun. Mm-hmm. They think of school as boring and, you know, homework. Mm-hmm. But when they do code.org in schools, that's completely fun. In fact, we regularly hear from teachers that the students don't want to go to recess because they want to continue coding, which they've never heard of for other things they do. And that's because coding doesn't automatically make you think it's fun, but when you use code.org, it has Star Wars or the Angry Birds or Minecraft, and you're writing the code to control R2-D2, and you make your own R2-D2 game, that's fun. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you don't just play the game, you create the game, and then you play the game, mm-hmm. and then you put it on your phone and play the game and can take it home to show your mom. Mm-hmm. That's so much more exciting than what most of third grade or fourth grade involves. And yet, at the same time, you're learning a whole lot of concepts. Mm. So the combination of making it fun, making it play, but also actually having something that you learn from it is why it is spreading so quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. We had a chance to do a partnership with the Yale University to do research around our content. Mm-hmm. So before them actually deciding to work with us, they tried our games, and they were like, I mean, this is exactly what we're looking for. Not only the educational content, but actually how can you mix entertainment and educational content to give a more engaging experience to kids. I remember attending one of the sessions where they were doing the research, and kids, thanks to these battles and these characters, they were like just going through all the math content and all the different operations, because for them it was, how can I get the next character? How can I win the next battle? The only way to actually achieve that is to go through the educational content. So when they have like these like elements of not only focusing on the educational content, but actually having like a bigger reward for them, where they actually like engage with the story, the characters, and everything, it changes everything. So it's not education anymore. It's a more exciting experience.
So the irony is that when you're playing, you work harder.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And you work for longer, right?
Yeah.
So, but by the way, David, I think I have a way for you to raise money. I think you need to do your voiceover. Maybe, I don't know, maybe like people's answering machines, you know? I don't know, what do you...
Sería genial.
That would be great. It would be great for my videos to be dubbed in other languages with voiceovers, because it's really difficult to watch a math class with subtitles. So if anybody here does voiceovers, let me know. That would be wonderful. But I don't want to be a competitor to get Khan Academy or anything like that.
I think that would be great. You and Khan Academy, head to head. You know, I'd like to...
Ahora estamos ahí.
Well, we're getting there. I am Khan Academy in the Spanish language. In Spanish, I am Khan Academy.
Me encanta.
And I really love the work that Khan Academy does. In fact, I was imitating Khan Academy when I started recording my videos. I looked at what Mr. Khan was doing, and it really inspired me. I said that if he can help thousands of students all over the world, English-speaking students, I'll try to do the same thing in Spanish. So he was the benchmark for me, so I thank him.
I think Sal Khan would say he's the Unicos of English. you know, I'd like to open it up for questions a little bit. Let's see if people have some thoughts they'd like to share with the panel. I have three rules for panels in the Q&A. Tell us who you are. Tell us, if you'd like to, where you're from. And the third and most important rule, please, I beg of you, make it a question. And as short as possible, too, because we have a lot of people who want to get to the questions. I'll give an award for the shortest question. So there's a mic here? Yeah. Is there only one mic?
No, there's none.
Okay. Just choose the first question. It's up to you.
Thank you for the insights. My name is Vishal. I'm from Dreamy Dream India. The question I have is, I think from the morning, the question we are sitting on is, what is the purpose of education? And the perspective I'm picking up here, and I would like to just challenge the panel on that, is that we're still trying to teach old things in a new way.
You say all things?
Old.
Okay.
So we're still focusing on mathematics and languages and social sciences. We're trying to find new ways to teach them, but not really asking the question of what is the purpose of education and what skills do kids need to leapfrog and be prepared for the future.
I think I know who would tackle that, but I'm going to open it up to anybody. So the idea is we're not pressing on the real question, which is, should we be teaching the things we're teaching? Forget how we do it. The what question, right?
Yeah, well, I think the purpose of education is to prepare students for their future life. And in the 21st century, we should be rethinking what we're teaching them. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't teach math or reading and writing. We should for sure teach math and reading and writing. But there's many new skills that we never taught before that are as important or perhaps even more important. The reason we advocate for computer science is because it's becoming increasingly foundational to every industry, to every field of science. Mm. But aside from computer science, financial literacy is something that is increasingly important, yet not taught in the school system. I believe statistics is more important than calculus, And yet in most schools, more schools teach much more advanced math than statistics. Mm. So I highly encourage all education leaders to ask your question of what should we be teaching these students, not just how, and what should be the new curriculum of the future.
Is for other panels, is your what changing? Have you discovered that you need to be teaching something different?
For us, we look at the sort of four main domains of early childhood development. So we're sort of looking at language development, socio-emotional skills, intellectual development, so thinking skills, decision-making, analytical skills, critical thinking, and physical skills. So we do that sort of through outdoor play. And so I think essentially what we're trying to do is use the teaching as a tool to aid childhood development. So I guess our content is not domain, it's not domain specific. It's these sort of very foundational life skills. And I guess sort of all education really is geared towards that, because no matter what you're teaching, it's things like a lot of trial and error, resilience, social skills, getting on with each other, sort of listening, concentration, memory, all of these things are so crucial. And I guess sort of, There are multiple ways for children to get those things, but for us, that's what it's all about. And I would imagine that the other guys would probably say similar, hopefully.
Yeah. It's okay if you don't agree.
Easy.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Of course.
Let's get one over on this side. Remember who you are, where you're from, and make it a question.
Great. Good morning. Thank you. My name is Gina Cicerone, and I head up the innovation work at Teach First, which is based in the United Kingdom, part of the Teach for All network. My question is picking up on the topic of sustainability and scalability, and I think it's really interesting hearing about how your organizations have scaled, and one of the key things is about impact and not just reach. And so I'm really curious if you can share what you've done to date to evaluate your work, what you've learned in terms of narrowing the gap, and what you still hope to achieve, and where you've seen that some of the challenges are.
Wow, that's, by my count, that's 12 questions, 3 times 4.
Well, in our case,
so impact versus reach. Let's start with that.
Well, in our case, I mean, thanks to this opportunity with Yale University, we did a research during 2 years. We just published the white paper, the findings last year, and the finding is that kids who use Yogomi improve their math skills compared to those who don't use our math content. We focus for this study on first grade and math. Kids played 2 hours per week during 4 weeks, and with that time playing our content, they actually improve their math skills. So that's really important for us. I mean, there's a lot of competition in our space, the direct-to-consumer product. So for us, we want to add this level of validation. Not because we have a super talented academic team in the company. The product is actually educational. We wanted to go and have the time to work with a university to actually go through all this research, to make sure that it's educational, not only because we say so, but because there's some proof of that behind the product.
Thanks.
Thanks for the question. Yes, so we're in the process of working with the Institute for Fiscal Studies in London, who are conducting a randomised control trial at the moment. Baseline report about to be published, so keep watching
Stay
our
tuned.
Website. But also what we're quite excited about is the randomised control trial obviously is quite a static beast by nature. Obviously, it's sort of relatively controlled environment to avoid contamination. And as we scale, what we want to know is, as we scale, there's obviously a massive risk that you'll lose quality in the scaling process. So what we're quite excited about is we're looking at sort of based on the RCT, using some of the key indicators about what assessments, what instruments work well and that, we're creating a sort of snapshot rapid evaluation that we're doing sort of as we scale, so that we can not only have the RCT, but we can look at, as we iterate, sort of how we move away from the results and what changes to the impact. So I think evaluation is absolutely critical. Obviously, no one wants to scale a program that doesn't work.
So
wouldn't be the first time. I mean,
it wouldn't. And I mean, actually, having said that, it's also really valid to learn about what doesn't work and why. So I think yes to evaluation, very important.
Thanks, David.
We have the advantage that we have a team of engineers and we have teachers from all over the world. These people have joined this project altruistically. We do have some income using YouTube. We make a little bit of money. It's not like it is in the US and Spain, but we get a little bit of money or we get a small contribution from a company and we can use that money to grow. Right now we're starting to talk to certain multinational corporations to see if they can sponsor the project. Because right now our only goal is to hire teachers so that they can record videos in biology, statistics, computer science, other subjects. The idea is for us to grow and for us to help more students. Meanwhile, we're doing it altruistically and we all have our day jobs. That's what we support our project with, and we just work with our passion, and it's scaling up on its own. Right now, we are planning something. Our engineers are designing a tool to allow professors and teachers to use Unicos in a specific way to see what students have seen videos and what students haven't. They could use Unicos as a platform to do homework, and the teachers would be able to oversee what their students are doing better. We're hoping that we can use that in schools. And if not, we'll just keep struggling because we'll just keep pushing forward to do what we do. We can still record videos, and our teachers love to help other people, and they love the idea, so we keep moving forward.
Sustainability and then impact versus reach and evaluating it. For sustainability, you know, we try to change the actual school system, not just providing a technological tool. And we've worked with 43 states to change the curriculum policy at the state level and with about 200 school districts to change curriculum at the level of the school district. So all of the largest school districts in the United States have worked with us, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, et cetera. From a standpoint of evaluation, there's two things we try to test. One is, are the students learning computer science, which they better be learning that because that's what we are teaching them. And in our high school classes, in the advanced placement class, which is a college-level course, 73% of our students pass the exam. And this is, remember, their teacher never learned computer science, but that teacher using code.org is enabling 73% of students to pass a college-level advanced placement exam. The other thing we've been evaluating is whether teaching coding and computer science helps in other subjects. And this might be the most interesting, which is we just worked with a third-party researcher that found that in third, fourth, and fifth grades, the students that used code.org more performed better at their math and science and English and literature exams at the state level. So, and that, I think, is an interesting finding in general, just because it helps engage students more in school and make school more fun so they get better at everything.
So, David, this is not your day job?
Yes, I am a teacher in an academy, and I use this as a service when I'm not teaching to help students pass their exams. I'm a consultant. I have a lot of work, and I just manage to work a few hours a day on Unicos, and during my vacations and on weekends, I record more videos.
And you sleep sometimes? Here and there.
En los aviones, in the plane.
On planes.
I'm going to get to more questions. I want to talk a little bit about this idea of things being free. Because it sounds like what most of you are doing, there's at least the intention of keeping it, keeping it free. For institutions or for families, for teachers. But, you know, as we're all hearing pretty much all of you talk kind of in a sort of implicit way, this is expensive stuff. It costs a lot to produce. It costs a lot to make it good, to, you know, keep the fidelity, to, in Hadi's case, to, you know, travel the the not only the country but the world trying to make sure that you know, school systems sort of work this into just how they operate. You know, it's like free parking, right? Free parking isn't free, right? What you guys do is free, but it's not really free. Can you offer some thoughts on, I guess it's a different kind of sustainability, right? I had the same conversation with Luis Vonan of Duolingo, right? You know, it's Duolingo is this sort of, you know, this language app that all of my kids' friends are using, and it's free, and he intends to keep it free, but he's got very clever and interesting ways of paying for it around the edges that never affect the users. It's sort of open to anybody. How do you keep what you're doing free without going broke? Is that the right? Maybe that's not even the right question. I mean, maybe let's.
All the material on code.org is free. It's not fake free.
Okay.
And in fact, it's so free, most of our videos are licensed under Creative Commons, which means Unicos could take the video and post it on their YouTube channel and just say, it's our video. You can literally copy the content. All of the technology is open source. And in fact, in Russia, they don't want the students using code.org, so they've made their own Russian version using our open source platform and just copied all the stuff. And we're okay with that. We're very willing to let education... The investment we make in high quality content, we want to reach as many students as possible.
So is it just you know, Silicon Valley investors opening their wallets for you?
There's a lot of either technology companies or founders of technology companies who themselves became very wealthy because of the skills they learned when they were young, and just thought this is something that every student should have the opportunity to learn. So far we've been very lucky to have folks like Microsoft and Amazon and Facebook be such strong supporters of ours that we make this pledge of making it free.
So what about everybody else? Yes.
Working part-time as a...
I think next time you're on a plane and you see Hadi, don't fall asleep, okay? You just follow Hadi wherever he's going. Anybody else want to talk about?
I mean, in our case, we're a for-profit company. With the first versions of our product, we found out that parents are willing to pay for a subscription product like the one we have. And thanks to that, we managed to raise right now over $35 million in venture capital. But now with all this product, as I was mentioning, our effort to have it accessible for free for schools is something that we're actually working on right now. At the end, parents care about what their kids are using, so we want to like get teachers to actually like use the content inside of the classroom.
So you've got a consumer version that's paid and
a
school version that's paid.
Yes.
At the moment we're grant funded and we're heavily dependent on grants, but the aim long term is that we would like the governments of the countries that we work in to pay for the project and just incorporate it into the kindergarten budget. To keep, obviously, we're working in poor countries, and we realise therefore that the budget per child has to be extremely low. We're looking for sort of under $10 per year per child, and the way that we do that is obviously all the games are made from local materials, the mothers work on a voluntary basis, the teachers do the teaching as part of their regular duties, it all is sort of integrated into the system. So our sustainability plan is basically keep the programme as sort of operating within the systems that are already there, and the extra inputs, they have to just be sort of as pared back as possible. So that's our plan.
More questions? Yeah, over here in the back.
Hi there, I'm Felipe Gibi from Brazil. My question is to Manolo and Hadi. We teach English online, and we are working with public schools right now. We have faced resistance from the teachers because we see students learning faster than them sometimes.
On your platform?
Through our platform. Mm-hmm. And in Brazil, 97% of the teachers don't speak English. The English teachers don't speak English. How do you guys deal with the resistance from the teachers? Because the teachers come to the Secretary of Education and say, this program is challenging us. And then the Secretary of Education come to us and say, you know, it's hard. The students are learning, but the teachers, how do you deal with it?
So it's kind of a question about control, right? I mean, who's in control?
We're lucky we have the opposite problem, which is the teachers go to the secretaries of education and say, you need to be teaching this because we love it so much. We have, I'd say, the exact opposite of teacher resistance. But I think part of that is because in your situation, the teacher doesn't think that English should be taught with a computer. In our case, they assume if it's computer science, the computer is going to be a computer involved. And the teacher doesn't know coding or computer science themselves, so they're happy to learn along with their own students to learn something they never learned before. There is, though, this challenge of some students go ahead of other students, and what we encourage for the teachers is to find the students that are farther ahead and bring them to the front of the class and have them help you do your job. And so the student that is learning ahead of the other students can start developing leadership skills instead of just finishing 10 lessons faster than everybody else.
But this gentleman's question was kind of a political question in a way. Maybe you could answer the political piece of that, which is how do you turn the tide?
We have the reverse political situation. He has the situation where the ministry wants this and the teachers are resisting it.
Right.
We have the opposite, which is this ground-up movement of teachers,
sure,
where it's spreading amongst teachers. And then we go to government leaders with the data saying, look, there's 10,000 teachers in your, you know, in your jurisdiction already doing this. Why don't we roll it out to every school?
What would you push on if you were advising this gentleman?
The resistance you described most of all was the students learning faster than the teachers. I would encourage to find a way to get that student to become a teacher, you know, to join the teacher at the front of the classroom, because I think the student who's learning the fastest can then develop leadership skills and make the job easier for the teacher rather than getting ahead of them and challenging the teacher.
Yeah, and I mean, at the end, I mean, also depends on the location. In our case, in Mexico, private schools are adopting coding classes. Now there's a big movement also in public schools, but it's not easy. We are dealing with teachers that don't want to, like, learn new things. These last 2 years, there were, like, some serious updates on how teachers are actually evaluated or how teachers are selected to be given a lesson, to be part of a school. So that doesn't help, of course. We actually started, our first client some years ago was a private school. We tried to scale that. It wasn't easy. So that's, I mean, the reason why we sell to parents is actually because of that. Now we are going back into trying to get into the schools, but with all this approach of the product being free, even with the product being free, it's not easy. So this concept of selling to schools is...
Can I just add, which is... I mean, it's not the same, but it's sort of similar to the problem that we faced, where it's sort of the issue of potentially teachers seeing you as trying to bypass them rather than work through them. So I would say that anything that you can do to really empower the teachers and make them the owners of the solution, the more buy-in, obviously, from the teachers that you have, the more likely that the program is to succeed. So anything that you can add on to market rigorously to the teachers, to really get them to own the program and to be the ones sort of steering it, I think would really help with that.
Great. Other questions? In the back. We're going to come to the front soon, I promise.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Komal. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Lab4U, and I am from Chile. And my question is, now that we understand that the product has impact, in Latin America, we face that many schools lack the infrastructure, basic internet, So I would like to know, how has your conversation been with government official or district leaders to improve that infrastructure? We might have computers or tablets in schools, but the internet is a problem. How has your conversation been with district leaders, for example, to improve that?
Anybody?
En mi caso, los videos de YouTube.
In my case, people can download videos from YouTube. I'm not sure what the situation is like in Latin America. I'm not sure if there's full coverage. I'm not sure if they have access to it in every school or in libraries. However, I have many viewers in Latin America, and none of them has ever told me, well, I can't watch the videos because I don't have the internet. When I was young, I would go to the library, and that's the only place that I could get information. So today, there are young people that don't have access to internet in their homes. And they have the option of going to a cafe or a library to get online, or a train station or something like that. That is an issue, and it needs to be solved. I hope internet can reach everywhere in the world, because until we achieve that, education will not be truly universal. That is a very important challenge, but it's a political challenge, not one for us.
Some years ago, we decided we didn't want it to depend on governments to really like sell or have our product more reach. As an example, this government, the current government in Mexico, gave these tablets, like Android tablets, to, I think it was like 1 million students some years ago. The thing is, the content was really bad. They were missing a lot of content. 2 years ago, I attended a meeting with the team involved in this tablet project. They don't even want to mention the project. It's, 2 years after they gave away these tablets, it's like prohibited to talk about the project. They are just waiting for these students that received the tablet in fifth grade to complete elementary school, so there's no like proof of this project being there.
Never existed.
Yeah, I mean, when you depend on governments, it's like a lot of things happening there that you really don't want to be part of.
Yeah, Rebecca, what was the in the book the program? It was the tablets that were basically not connected. Can I ask you to come up and talk for 30 seconds about that? Because that might be an interesting way to sort of square the circle.
Yeah, the book opens with a story from an NGO called Pratam, which many of us know, that's based out of India. And their founders, Madhav Chavan and Rukmini Banerjee, did an experiment where they have for years been developing educational content in Hindi and local languages and testing it and making sure it works. And then they loaded up a bunch of hardy tablets and basically brought them to, I don't know, their pilot was 400 rural villages. That was their initial pilot. And they said, two rules. One, kids have to share the tablet, 10 kids to a tablet, so two groups of five, and a parent has to charge the tablet at night. And then they just saw what happened. And it was offline. These are kids that didn't have any internet. And then they used every 2 months or 3 months, they would send back a community worker who would get the data off of what kids are, what are kids doing with the tablets, and onload new content. And it was exceptional. I mean, the first thing that the kids did is they hacked all the passwords to bypass the tablets and started doing their own content, making their own content. But it really, it boosted academic scores, but did so much more than that.
I mean, it strikes me that that's a possible
good example.
Reply to the questioner. I don't know. Does that help? Can we go back to you? Can we give that person a mic, please? Hang on.
Can maybe Hadi speak about the conversations he's had with government officials?
Sure. When I've spoken to ministries of education globally, but especially in Latin America, the message I hear is There's very few places that have connectivity in every school. The exceptions in Latin America, I think, are certainly Uruguay with Plan Ceibal in Costa Rica. But there's many countries that are investing in increasing it. So, for example, Paraguay or Ecuador have announced plans to not only get computers to every school, but even one-to-one computing. Argentina is on its way towards getting there. So I would say on the first front, we don't have one-to-one computing or even computers in every school, but it's improving. But the second thing I'd say for what we do for computer science, you don't need one-to-one computing. You need 20 to 30 computers for 1,000 students. That's enough to teach a computer science class in the school. And many, many schools actually have that. So, for example, in a city like Medellin in Colombia, you don't have one-to-one computing, but every single school has at least one computer lab that's connected and that works. For us, because we want to reach every child, we're now investing in trying to figure out how to make our entire curriculum and all of our videos work offline, disconnected as well. So for the schools that don't have that, we can give them something on a thumb drive that they can go from computer to computer to enable. We're not ready to roll that out. We're just getting started thinking about it. But I think that's going to be the way to reach every child if you think about countries that don't have good internet access.
Nice. Okay, let's move up to the front here. Can we get this gentleman in the second row? Thanks so much for your great short questions, by the way.
Hi, my name is Mark Reading from the Atlassian Foundation. My question is primarily for Hardy. Hardy, I can't recall how many languages you mentioned earlier that code.org content had been translated into, but my recollection was it was a very large number. And I guess for scaling purposes, often you will need to translate content into multi-languages. My question to you is, how have you gone about that? Have you created some sort of translation system, particularly when you've had content that presumably is evolving and rather than being static? So any insights that you can share in relation to translation would certainly be welcome.
Sure. I want to make sure I don't overstate. We have 400 hours of curriculum, and maybe 10 hours of it is very broadly translated. So our most popular one-hour tutorials are in over 50 languages, and they're translated by volunteers. Volunteers translate these instantly. When we create a new one, they get translated. And I think it's actually more than 50 languages. There's languages like Kazakh in Kazakhstan or Icelandic, Catalan in Barcelona. There's groups that have translated just our one-hour tutorials. Our next 50 hours of curriculum is translated into about 15 or 20 languages, and then the rest is only in English. So for us, one of our most important projects is to translate everything. And the way we do that is we use a system that enables crowdsourcing of the translation. So anybody can come in and translate, but then we work and identify regional partners in individual countries that have a real interest in doing it. So for example, in Barcelona, there's this group that wants to see computer science taught in Catalan. So we're not relying on the volunteers. That group is actually doing the work. They come into the crowdsourced system.
Gotcha. We have time for maybe one more question. Okay, this gentleman in the middle here.
Thank you. I'm Josh Muskin from Geneva Global. And I wanted to get back to the question about the title of the panel, Unburdening Teachers. And I think everyone agreed that it's much less about unburdening them than giving them a burden that they're enthusiastic to,
good point.
To carry and ridding them of the more mundane. But I'm wondering about how do we get the teachers to do what we're talking about? How do we get the teachers to teach different content, to teach differently? Some of it's about giving them the crutch is not the right word, but the tool of IT. But someone asked the question earlier about the capacity of the teachers, and I'd like to get into what are we doing to give the teachers the capacity and the motivation to do this, but not just the capacity, what I call intrinsic capacity, the tools that they have to manage, but what I call the extrinsic capacity, giving them the conditions in which to be able to do things differently. Mm. Rebecca mentioned earlier recognition as one of the four topics. Mm. If we're asking teachers to teach to personal skills, but we're still testing them on doing long division as the gate they have to pass through to be able to get to the next level, then we're really burdening the teachers in very different ways. So just to get some insights on that question.
That's a big question. It's a really big one, and I think it's an important one. So the idea is, you know, how, I mean, can I paraphrase? Do you mind? I mean, how do we sort of motivate teachers to do something sort of bigger?
Different content, different
way. Yeah, different content, different. Okay, that's a much better way. Different. How do we teach teachers to teach different content differently? In a way, I feel like we've been talking about this the whole time, but maybe let's maybe drill in a little closer.
I mean, so for us, we have a very structured, it's a very behavior change-based program. So a lot of energy on engaging the teachers at the beginning, getting them to realize why what they're doing now isn't the best way, why there's a good solution for them, why that solution will make it easier for them, what the benefits of the solution will be. And we put a lot of resource into training them, and then a lot of ongoing support. And I think ongoing support is often the thing that gets missed out, but it's absolutely crucial. They need to be part of a support network. They need that from the leadership of the system that they're affiliated to. They need that from their peers. In our case, they need it from the mothers who we're bringing in the classroom. They need it from the students. So they do need recognition. What we absolutely try to avoid at all costs is by giving them a monetary incentive. They have to have the intrinsic motivation, and it's our job, I'd say, as thought leaders, as change makers, to tap them and connect them to that motivator, to really give them the desire to change and then the support to do that. But I think that's where it's all at, like how to make that change happen. And that's sort of where we focus most of our attention, I'd say.
You know, it strikes me, you know, Rebecca mentioned at the very beginning this idea of where or what is education's Wikipedia moment. And as Hadi was talking about this sort of simultaneous, this translation stuff, it occurred to me that one of the amazing things about Wikipedia, it's free, by the way, but people create it for free. I mean, with the exception of maybe a couple of people on staff. And the people who are working on it are very excited about it. And maybe that's the question. How do you get people to work on a project like this, you know, no remuneration or no extra remuneration, big, massive thing you can barely get your arms around. You might only have a tiny little piece of it that's interesting to you, right? But that piece of it, people are sort of obsessive about it, right? We have about a minute and a half here. Any insights into like how to create those conditions that people really want to?
Have an interesting experience because most education tools are helping teachers do a better job of teaching the job they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
You know, you're a math teacher, you have to teach math, and you find a tool that works for you. We try to get teachers to teach something they're not supposed to do,
right.
You know, and to actually make time in their classroom to teach something that the school doesn't necessarily require or even want. And so motivating the teacher is a big part of what we need to do. And at Code.org, I think of ourselves as almost two things in one. One part is an online learning platform like a Khan Academy, but the other part is a social movement to basically wake up teachers and sort of make them feel like they're kind of taking a little bit more control over the education that their students are getting.
I think maybe, and that's an interesting way to put it. Maybe we need to create a social movement.
Yeah, we regularly use the language of calling this a teacher-powered movement. Mm. Recognizing teachers is a big part of what we do. And, you know, when Rebecca was showing the slide, or actually doing the raise of hands, asking who thinks schools are innovative or cutting edge, teachers feel the same way as well. Teachers... Yeah. They're regular people, and then they go to school, and they're like, oh, nothing is changing.
Sure.
And part of what has made Code.org successful is we tell these teachers, you can be the change that you want, and you know, make them feel like this is their thing. And that motivation is a big part of what helps them think about teaching different content with different tools.
So I wish we could talk a lot longer. We are pretty much at the end of our time. I want to thank these wonderful panelists, and also thank great audience for your wonderful questions. So please give everybody a round of applause.